This is a new fact I learned this month. The 2010s were the decade with the most and the biggest protests in all of history. There were demonstrations from Tahrir Square to Wall Street and to Hong Kong, and in those, more people took action against their governments in the 2010s than in any prior 10-year period, surpassing even the 1960s, what we traditionally think of as the protest decade. And many of those protests took a specific and historically novel form. As my good friend and my guest today explains in his latest book, If We Burn, protests in the 2010s often were, or at least claimed to be, leaderless. And instead of being organized by hierarchical parties or trade unions, these protests were spontaneous and horizontal. These weren't like the anti-Iraq war marches in the 2000s or the biggest Gaza protests we've seen recently, where hundreds of thousands of people go on an approved march from A to B. Instead, these were leaderless movements. Squares would often be occupied, sometimes tents would be erected, and entire new societies and forms of organizing would be imagined or even manifested in the here and now. And as it happens, I started the decade as part of a protest movement that had many of those characteristics.
Tonight, pockets of students had gathered outside the Treasury building, still confined along Whitehall by the police, but still carrying on their London protest. A bus shelter was set on fire, and at the Treasury itself, one student tried unsuccessfully to batter his way through the blast-proof glass. By nightfall, police had begun to slowly disperse the marchers, a process that will last some time. This was supposed to have been a protest by students at a threefold increase in university tuition fees. But instead, it's these images of a police van being looted by fringe elements that will be remembered.
Now, I can't claim to have looted any police vans, but I was part of the fringes who wanted the movement against tuition fees to move in a more revolutionary direction. As you'll hear in this episode, or you might know from my other work, my politics have changed quite a bit since then. Of course, though, it wasn't students protesting in London in late 2010 that were the most dramatic of this decade. And in February 2011, this happened.
6 o'clock in Cairo, and the news cascaded through the crowd. Across Egypt, millions were on the streets, erupting in excitement. He'd gone. After 30 years, gone. Cars honked their horns. It was a moment like no other in their lives. In Tahrir Square, the protesters were beside themselves. They'd done it. They'd won. They'd brought down President Mubarak.
The Arab Spring, which spread in part via Twitter, was the pinnacle of a moment when it seemed as if the internet would be an unstoppable tool for achieving freedom and democracy. But within 2 years, Egypt's military had overthrown the country's democratically elected president. They then went on to institute a regime even more harsh than Mubarak's. And it's that distance between the utopian hopes of the 2010s protest decade and the grimmer realities those protests often helped generate, which forms the starting point of the latest book by the writer Vincent Bevins. In If We Burn, the Mass Protest Decade and the Missing Revolution, Bevins argues that the ideologies and organizational forms which facilitated the unprecedented explosion of protests in the 2010s also meant that they were uniquely prone to defeat, or worse, co-option by reactionary forces. And Vincent himself had intimate access to one of the decade's protest waves that suffered that trajectory. In 2013, he was working as a foreign correspondent in Sao Paulo when protests against a hike in bus fares in that city grew into one of the largest national revolts in Brazilian history.
For 7 hours, the streets of Rio de Janeiro were packed with tens of thousands of protesters. Some Brazilians tried to get into Congress, taking their frustrations out on the buildings. The police responded with rubber bullets and tear gas. The unrest quickly spread to other cities, fueled by social media. It all began earlier this month when bus fares were raised. It set the stage for other grievances to spill out as Brazil gets set to host the World Cup next year and the Olympics in 2016. I came to continue the protest for change, says this man. We need improvements in Brazil now. When the problem becomes the norm, we have no option. The protesters are tapping into widespread anger at the lack of public services. The investment in marquee sporting events instead of basic needs have reached a boiling point.
The 2013 protests in Brazil were led by left-wing activists hoping to push Brazil's social democratic government to the left. And in fact, the country's president at the time, Dilma Rousseff, was sympathetic to the protesters and their aims, as was Benjamin Haddad. He was the mayor of Sao Paulo, and so that's where the protests started. He would go on to be a presidential candidate for the PT, so Brazil's Workers' Party. However, as the street demonstrations grew and lacking any strong leadership, in fact, with the founders of the movement rejecting strong leadership, the movement, which started in 2013, gained a meaning that wasn't really of the left. And the country's right were alert to the ability to contest their character, to try and shape the meaning of those protests. And in 2016, the right saw their chance to lead a movement of their own.
1.4 million people in Sao Paulo, proudly sporting the colours of Brazil. The patriotic crowds have swapped their football chants for a political message. Get Dilma out.
I came to protest against corruption in Brazil. The only way to solve this is to take to the streets and show them what we want.
An equal turnout in Rio de Janeiro, further testing the president's political survival skills in Latin America's largest economy. Dilma Rousseff's approval ratings have sunk to a record low as her Workers' Party faces a probe into massive bribes and embezzlement involving state oil company Petrobras.
I feel guilty. I believed in them like all the Brazilian people did. And we end up with corruption. So now we want the corrupt out.
As Vincent Bevins explains, those charges of corruption had more to do with a right-wing political witch hunt than any real desire to clean up Brazilian politics. But later that year, the movement achieved their goal. Dilma was impeached. In Dilma's hearing, Jair Bolsonaro, then a renegade and little-known senator, dedicated his vote to the head of the secret police under Brazil's military dictatorship. Now, Dilma had personally suffered torture under that military regime, so it was a shocking and detestable move by Bolsonaro. But 2 years later, he would be president. And thus, as in Egypt, a decade of protests left Brazil in a more authoritarian and divided state in 2020 than it had been 10 years earlier. So what can we learn from a decade of explosive protests and failed revolutions? How harshly should we judge a generation of activists who took to the streets with revolutionary pretensions but a lack of concrete plans? And does the 2010s leave the concept of leaderless movements in history's garbage heap? I've divided my interview with Vincent into two parts. In this first episode, we discuss protest movements within democracies, so like the UK and Brazil. In the second part, which I'll release soon, we discuss protests in non-democratic systems, so that's including Egypt. We cover an awful lot in this interview, and Vincent is an incredibly knowledgeable and thoughtful guy, so I hope you get as much out of the interview as I did. Vincent Bevins, welcome to Crash Course.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me.
All right, your book is kind of an argument. It's also a history. The history is of the decade, the 2010s. And I suppose I'd kind of memory hold this, maybe because, we've all had our experiences of the protests in the 2010s. And, some people try to remember them, some people try and forget them. But I had sort of forgotten how many protests there were. And you said this was the decade with the most protests in all of history.
Yeah.
So more than the 1960s.
Yeah.
And when I read that, I was kind of like, oh, I did not realize that. So how would you explain to someone how the 2010s was the most protestful decade ever?
Yeah, so as far as we know, obviously it's not easy to calculate how many people participated in protests, but the best information we have is that more people took part in mass protests than any other point in history. And the last time, the previous record was the 1960s, like the famous global cycle of contention in the 60s, which was really global. Now, in the 2010s, what we saw is a huge number of mass protest events, most famously starting off with what was became to be called the Arab Spring by people like me. That ends up mattering for the story. And then quite a lot of protest events that were inspired in some way by what happened in the Arab Spring, and especially in Tahrir Square in Cairo. And so if you draw that very clean line at the between 2010 and 2020, which I choose to do because it serves my purposes, I think we can call it the mass protest decade. That's what I put in the subtitle. I think of the book more as a history than an argument. I like to think that the history is really what matters, and the conclusions readers can agree with or disagree with based on what's in the actual story. But that's how I framed it, yeah. The decade of protest, yeah.
I suppose if there is an argument, it's about sort of organizational structures, which we'll get onto. I suppose, first of all, the 2010s, it being the decade with the most protests ever, you know, more than the 1960s, have you got a sort of elevator explanation, you know, a quick fire explanation of why that was? Is it social media? Is it the financial crisis? Is it just the fact that everyone saw the Arab Spring, the so-called Arab Spring, and decided to copy it? I mean, why would you look at sort of the 2010s from a distance and say, oh yeah, that makes sense that that had so many protests?
I think those three things matter. The three things you just said matter. The response to the financial crisis of 2008, the response to the inadequacy of the government responses to the financial crisis. Social media matters. It's one of many things that matters. Copying of the Arab Spring matters. Another thing that matters is that this particular type of response to injustice, a very particular way to act when a government abuses its authority or when elites are committing abuses against the people, became far easier to do than all the other types of responses that have been historically possible, privileged in different epochs. So in the 2010s, I find that a very specific recipe, let's say, of ingredients becomes not only sort of tactically and morally privileged, people think of it as the thing that they could or should do, it becomes easier to do than ever before, and it becomes easier to do than all the other things that you could do. So those are the four elements that I would sort of deliver in an elevator. If I had a little bit more time, I would add in my book the cases that I choose in order to be included in the work that I chose to construct. A mass protest had to get so big that it overthrows a government or fundamentally destabilizes a government. So in any case, when that happens, you're always looking at multiple causality and you're always looking at more than four things. So those four things are usually part of the story. And in each individual case, I'll look at 10 to 13 cases, but you have others that vary widely depending on context.
I think that ease of it is really persuasive, like that social media just makes it shed loads easier to get thousands of people in a square. I mean, it also makes it shed loads easier for, I mean, we'll get onto this,
right,
but for sort of images of cops beating up people to,
yes,
to go viral.
Yeah.
That wouldn't have happened probably before the 2010s. You say it's more of a history book. It also has an argument. I think the argument is about horizontalism. First of all, what is horizontalism?
Yeah, horizontalism is the intentional attempt to organize political struggles or social movements along totally anti-hierarchical lines. So there will be no division between, there'll be no kind of leaders, no kind of spokespersons, often no division of labor, and often there is no decision that is allowed to be made except through consensus. Now, historically, how this emerges is that you get the concrete reaction to the collapse of representative institutions in Argentina in 2001. Now, this happens concretely in reality. People form neighborhood assemblies. There are no leaders. There's very little interest in the political parties that have proved totally inadequate. And then horizontalism is the people around the world that take inspiration from what has actually happened and turn it into a sort of, an intentional practice. It becomes something that you believe is better than the other ways of doing things, rather than the word that was actually used in the Argentine context in 2001 was just horizontality. And that distinction starts to matter. I don't want to get ahead of things.
So the Argentina example, that's, so there's a debt crisis, right? The state to some degree collapses. And then these assemblies fill the void of the state. Am I getting that right? Or is that
fill the void of the state because they don't govern, no one's governing.
Right, okay.
But that they fill the days of the people that have no jobs.
And this actually is part of the critique of horizontalism.
Though this ends up having the mattering as well, is that quite a lot of people are unemployed at this time. And so people do want to gather with people in their neighborhoods and have discussions about what to do. And sometimes, so some of these assemblies do occupy factories and they do, you know, this really inspires a lot of people around the world more than it like transforms Argentina along like libertarian communist lines. That doesn't exactly happen, but it seems to prefigure a possibility, a way of organizing, which is privileged. And it gets refracted through a lot of movements, especially in the United States, that say, oh no, this is not only something that happened here. This is something that should be done. This is the best way to organize. And across the 2010s, that distinction does start to matter. There are a small amount of people that are really horizontalist, that really believe explicitly in a set of principles and put them forward, or often like refuse to deviate from them. But often you just have a lot more of the horizontality, which was so important back in Argentina, because there was, even if people might have wanted to have them, there just weren't representative structures that were functioning.
Yeah, I suppose in some examples, so we're going to get onto Egypt, obviously, but sometimes, you know, they couldn't presumably have political parties, right? Because it was a somewhat authoritarian system. So it made sense that when the Arab Spring comes around, you're going to have a lot of people who aren't in, you know, strong civil society organizations.
The civil society organizations were not strong in Egypt. And this matters quite a lot in Egypt. And again, there was a lot of people that were trying to build revolutionary political parties, that were trying to build regular parliamentary political parties. Labor action does matter quite a lot, but the Egyptian Labor Federation, unlike the Tunisian Labor Federation, can't really act autonomously in a way that matters in moments of revolutionary opportunity. And so, yes, you have the Egyptian example is often what I use to explain the concrete horizontality that comes as a result of the decimation of civil society under dictatorship and neoliberal economic policy.
It's a bit harsh, I suppose, to look at the Egyptian revolution and said, you probably should have had some more organized political parties.
Well, no, because I mean, the people that were, well, this is something. So this slippage happens when people like me and you show up, because a lot of the people that really put together Tahrir Square 2011 have ideology. They believe in organizing. They've spent 11 years building networks and activist groups, usually in support of Palestine, often with a huge awareness of a keen awareness of the importance of labor action, and often with an idea that their uprising is supposed to be, must be, if democracy means anything in the Egyptian context, opposed to Western power in the region. And then Western media show up and say, oh, they're doing post-ideology, structureless, totally horizontal, prefigurative protest. And they want to just basically join the West. They want to be like America Junior. And the original organizers watch in horror as this like media representation is imposed on them by people with the biggest microphones in the global system, which is journalists in the English language media.
You also go back to the 60s, right? The Students for a Democratic Society in the United States. Talk about them.
Sure. So what I try to do in the book is this package. I try to present this package of contention, this particular way of responding to injustice and that becomes hegemonic in the 2010s. And I try to break it down into its constituents parts and historicize every single one of them and say, because this type of response becomes so hegemonic that it starts to become natural, even though if you take a step back, this is not always how things have worked. So those elements are the apparently spontaneous, leaderless, horizontally structured, digitally coordinated mass protest in a public square or public space that is said to prefigure the society that it wants to create. Now, the best way to tell the story of how prefiguration and protest emerge in a way that is relevant for the 2010s, I think, is to look at the first half of the 1960s in the United States. Students for Democratic Society at the very beginning. So this is very much a U.S. and early 1960s story, because things are different in Western Europe and they're different in the second half of the 60s. They see the Soviet Union, this is in the Port Huron statement, they see the Soviet Union as having sort of ossified the hierarchies that were part of the revolutionary process into a state which is repressive. And also they were very, very inspired by the public acts of civil disobedience that constituted the civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s. They sort of, in the first couple of years in the 1960s, discover the power of mass protest. Mass protest becomes much, much more, it sort of grows rapidly, again, because of media, just like it does in the 2010s. Back then, media is television and newspapers, which was, you know, media is a new thing for human society. And the idea of having the whole world see what you're doing the next day was really new, just like, you know, in 2011 was new to have the whole world see what you're doing 1 minute later. So in the first half of the 1960s in the United States, protest enters sort of like the national consciousness and then global consciousness as a result of the Vietnam War protests, which come out of this approach to politics. And prefiguration, the idea that the SDS introduces at the very beginning of the 1960s, the idea that, well, we don't want to do the things that we end up seeing happen in the bad states that we want to avoid becoming. So we want to now start to experiment with non-hierarchical or less hierarchical structures. And then that really becomes much, much more pronounced by the era of the anti-globalization movement, the alter-globalization movement, where like all hierarchy of any kind is absolutely rejected. But they bring prefiguration back into Western politics, which is like, it, you know, there's like a long history of where it came from before that. But that's what I think that matters about that story.
So I'm not going to read you many quotes back of your book, but I have one here because it sort of stuck out to me fairly early on. And this is, it's not about Americans, about the 68 in France. And, you know, I presume these weren't people who were sort of self-consciously horizontalist.
No, not at all.
It was a somewhat spontaneous movement to some degree.
It happened very quickly. Yeah. Okay.
But I'll read you this quote, and it's about how the memory of 1968 was redefined. So you said, over the years that followed, many of the revolutionaries watched in horror as the events were redefined and reinterpreted until they were unrecognizable. No one had planned May 68, and no one could credibly claim to speak for the uprising. Some of the class of 1968 had graduated to establishment positions in bourgeois Parisian societies, and these voices tended to see May as a dream that had eventually come true rather than a failed revolution. So when French television stations asked 68ers to explain what happened, they called upon those respectable or eloquent figures who, whether this was intentional or not, reflected the dominant values in France in the 70s and 80s. The actual spark for the revolt had been the Vietnam War, and its initial targets were clear: capitalism, US imperialism, and Charles de Gaulle. But a narrative took shape that claimed the events were actually about individualism and self-expression, not collective action. They were about the liberation of desire, not humanity. Now, I sort of read this in your book as an argument as to how 1968 was misrepresented.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not an expert on 1968.
Sure.
But one of the reasons I'm somewhat cynical about protests is because when I look back at sort of the process explosion that I was part of in the 2010s, early 2010s, the student movement especially, we thought it was about anti-capitalism.
Right.
We thought it was about solidarity. You know, we thought it was about revolution. And when I look back at it, I'm thinking, actually, even from my own part,
uh-huh,
my sort of objective view of the situation is we were a bunch of kids who were expressing ourselves and were kind of high off the idea that we have all of this agency. And I don't think we really were doing it for anyone else in a serious way. You know, we're in the streets. Whose streets? Our streets. It's like, who did we think we were? You know, I kind of feel like lots of protest movements are and especially this kind of protest movement, you know, middle-class kids in the streets,
mm-hmm,
that is a sort of exercise in self-expression, whether or not they think they're protesting capitalism.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. Was that high what you were chasing before you went, or did that appear in the middle and then that became more important to you individually back in 2011 or 2010?
Well, no, so I suppose my trajectory or sort of understanding of it. So at the time, we thought we were doing something really revolutionary and important. You know, there was never a moment during that protest where I thought, this is great because I'm expressing myself.
Mm-hmm.
At the front of my mind, what I thought I was doing
was to keep school fees down, right?
Was to keep school fees down. But what we also thought we were doing, we were like anarchist revolutionaries. We thought we were challenging the state.
Right.
Everyone was going to see that, you know, capitalism was a sham and representative democracy was a sham. And we were fighting for this sort of revolutionary struggle. The whole time I thought that. Then afterwards, there was sort of the come down of sort of, oh, we didn't remotely achieve what we wanted to achieve.
Right.
You know, the tactics were wrong. And then looking back at it a few years later, I was like, that's just crazy altogether. You know, what we wanted was silly. The way we tried to get it was crazy.
Do you think it was silly to want to keep the university fees down?
Well, no, I think keeping the university fees down is fine. That's just
right.
But the we thought it was something more than that. Mm-hmm. You know, we thought this was an expression of anti-capitalism, an expression against bourgeois liberal democracy.
So you're doing some kind of an inversion of that passage, right? So you're saying...
I'm saying that...
It was about self-expression, but that's bad. Whereas this person is saying it wasn't about self-expression, and that's good. Right, because the dominant French narrative was like, oh, actually, the kids wanted self-expression, and that's an amazing thing. The kids needed more self-expression. We've given that to them with, like, all of the cool movies and music and, like, you know, the rock generation. You know, that's great. But you're saying, actually, it was about me and my friends wanting to control some part of the street and to feel something powerful, but that was a bad thing. We shouldn't have wanted to feel that way.
So I think for my life,
right,
it was quite good. Like, I think it's quite nice for young people to get the chance to organize non-hierarchically, to sort of feel like they have a lot of agency. You know, I made a lot of really good friends that I still have until now. But I'm wondering if we could find a way to do that that was slightly less obnoxious and didn't block a lot of people getting to their workplace or cost the police loads of money, you know? I feel like maybe that could be achieved at some kind of summer camp.
Sure, sure. So I think that protests do a lot of things. I think that primarily, if you look at the emergence of protest historically and when they're often very effective, they are communicative acts. It is a group of people saying, yeah, we already vote, you already take polls, but this group of people feels really strongly about this thing. And it's a message that's delivered to elites loud and clear. This many people really care about this thing. We're willing to put our lives on the line. We're willing to, you know, disrupt.
Well, we weren't putting our lives on the line.
No, you weren't. In my book, this tends to be the case very quickly. And arguably, if things had gone, I mean, I went to a couple of the protests in the UK back in 2010-11, but argue if things had gone the way that they were supposed to, according to the script of like Occupy Wall Street or 2010, then like people would have ended up like dying. Like if there was actually like, if a revolutionary situation had been generated.
Oh my God, that would have been a disaster if we'd got what we wanted. Obviously the school fee's fine, but if we got the rest of what we wanted.
Yeah, because people ask me what Occupy Wall Street often, and again, I wasn't in the United States at the time, I was in Brazil. I think that Occupy Wall Street ended up transforming the US in a very positive way, but it didn't do what it wanted to do in the first place, which was to reproduce Tahrir Square in New York. Adbusters magazine said we should do Tahrir in New York. Now I think what would have happened actually if you really shut down the US for a few weeks or months in the United States at that point, given, you know, political and military conditions in the United States, it starts to get hairy and you have to really, you know, be willing to embark on like an insurrection. always taking into account like how serious it can get for some participants. But as I said, I was trying to say, or forgot where I was, the protest is, I think, primarily communicative, which means it's always somehow in interaction with media, which is important in the story. I think it also, it transforms people. It brings people together. It does create ideas of the ways that people can be that are outside of day-to-day life. And as you say, like historically, this has existed in other ways. Like a lot of people in the literature compare the 2010 style of protest to medieval carnival. Like hierarchies are gone or inverted for a few days. This is very liberating. We learn that we're all the same sort of, and then you go back to your regular life. I think sometimes this happened in the 2010s. So they bring people together. They allow for new types of engagement with other human beings. They allow for people to discover their possibilities, and they deliver a message to elites. What happens in my book, in every case that I select, is that actually so many people show up that it's no longer just a protest. Now you have a revolutionary situation. Now you have a power vacuum. Now you have people, governments like a dictator fleeing to Saudi Arabia, or another government realizing, oh, if I don't do something, I'm going to be toppled. And this is the strange slippage that happens in a lot of the episodes in the 2010s, is that this kind of fundamentally communicative action, where with the use of social media, and I don't think it's about social media, but social media is one of the many, many things that contributes to these mass explosions. All that was necessary yesterday was that everyone was mad about the same thing. Now we need to either communicate with existing elites as to what we want quickly and coherently and credibly. We need to offer them the promise more or less that we're going to go home if we get something, or we need to form a revolutionary government. And this is what becomes repeatedly, tragically impossible in the 2010s. But just going back to that, the 1968 passage, I included it because it, you know, prefigures some things that happen. I mean, this, a lot of revolutionaries in the 2010s, and some of these quotes aren't in the book because they're too intense. They're too horrible. They're about like real depression. I don't want to like put people on the record with this kind of stuff. But that cognitive dissonance between what I know that I did versus what like CNN or everybody said that we were doing has been really difficult for some people to deal with.
I suppose I sometimes feel like people don't know what they're doing. As in, and I feel like I didn't know what I was doing.
So, yeah, it's like, yeah.
So the sort of the reframing of it as about self-expression might be more accurate than what the actual participant believes they are doing. I should clarify, I'm not like down on all sure. protests, but I'm sort of, I suppose I'm down on the revolutionary pretensions of myself
sure.
in 2010 and sure. 2011. And that sort of clouds sort of the way I look at, or colors, let's say the way I look mm-hmm. at certain protests. I will also say that this, you know, I feel a lot less confident in the way I feel about protests in the Global South because it's a very different situation and one yeah. in which I know less about. And as you say, I think many protests, even if it's not, you know, I don't regret that they didn't achieve their revolutionary demands.
Right.
Lots of their reformist demands come about, and that's great. So Occupy Wall Street, as you say, I think that probably led to Bernie Sanders to some degree.
I think a lot of Americans heard about a political discourse that was like, oh, I never knew about that. I'm going to look that up, which is kind of what the Bernie Sanders moment was too.
Yeah. So exactly the same as like Extinction Rebellion. Like the people who start it, you know, their big key demand is for like a people's assembly and sort of a big challenge to representative democracy and a bunch of stuff that I think is a bit, you know, I don't want that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if ever I speak about it in the media, I'm always like, don't obsess about what's in the manifesto. I mean, what's the effects of this? We talk more about climate change and maybe we'll invest more in green energy, right? Like, I'm a massive reformist, but fine, if they get my reforms in the news agenda,
sure,
fab.
Sure.
You know, so I just want to be clear. I'm not too down on this, but I'm...
Well, I guess I suppose even in the historically most disciplined and tightly organized and even sort of hierarchical movements in history. So like famously tight revolutionary parties, or even the civil rights movements in the 50s and 60s, they had rigorous like cadre formation and selection processes and discipline that was enforced on the people that were the main participants in the actions. Even the most like quote unquote vertical actions in human history still rely on quite a lot of other people that, in your words, don't know what they're doing. They know, they join for their own reasons and they're not part of this thing. You know, even like the Russian Revolution, like the vast majority of people were there for their own reasons. And this is kind of, I guess, the way that it goes, is that you have what people think at the moment, and then people like me, you know, like representation of narratives imposed upon them. And, you know, you can do better or worse at like fighting back and putting your own message forward. But I think, yeah, this tension happens, inevitably with mass political struggle. But in the case of most of the episodes in my book, people were willing to think revolution, you know, because it was, you know, this is, you know, this, you know, and it's relevant that you're talking about a very different system in Egypt in 2011 than you are in the UK in 2011. But then you get another slippage when the reproduction of tactics happens in places like in 2013, you get the second wave in 2013, when then you have Turkey, Brazil, and Ukraine. And all three of these cases are imperfect democracies, but they are democracies. So there's a strange realization that happens as you sort of start to win that, oh wait, this is quite different than Egypt or Tunisia. Like half, you know, quite a lot of people voted for this person, you know, like him or not, like her or not in the case of Brazil.
Yeah, I want to spend a while talking about Brazil because it's the one, I think, you know, it is the case that you talk most about in the book, partly because were you a participant or were you reporting on it?
I was a reporter, but I was one of the few reporters that was there from the beginning, largely because of my like class and social position. Like I just like, I had friends of the, like the music scene. So I was there from I was one of the few journalists that was there before the media flipped the script and started saying it was a good thing. But I was definitely a reporter. I was never like, I would have been always insistent that I was covering rather than participate. I think it's probably even illegal to participate.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to basics. Cause I don't actually think, I didn't know really that there was a huge protest movement in Brazil in 2013. Yeah. Maybe I was sort of somewhat aware of it.
A lot was going on.
But it doesn't have a place in the, or it didn't have a place in the forefront of my mind before I read your book. So sort of as a basic introduction of it, it's organized, well, originally, the original protest organized by a group called Movimiento Passe Libre, which means, what's the passe mean? Ticket, free ticket.
Yeah.
Free like, movement around the city.
Well, it's fair, like free fare movement is the best translation.
Right.
Yeah. So like passe is like, you know, like a pass.
Oh, that's like a bus pass. So
yeah.
Yeah, it's a movement for
Free fare
pass
movement.
Is free.
Yeah.
Free fare
there
movement.
You go. The free fare movement.
Okay, interview done. We've worked out what Maria del Paso Libre means. Talk about them. What were they? Why did they start protesting?
So they were, unlike many of the other participants in the 2010s, explicitly horizontalist. And I interviewed quite a lot of them for the book. And now many of them would say that they were dogmatically horizontalist. So this is a group that comes out of the anti or alter globalization movement. They've been doing this since 2005. They were formed out of Indie Media Brazil. People like exactly my age will probably remember how important this website was for covering the Seattle and then like the WTO IMF protests.
I used to check Indie Media when I was...
For me, the Indie Media like was the internet for a few years. Like when I was in high school in Southern California, I was like, you know, participating vicariously in like this uprising in Italy or something as a teenager. So they've been doing this thing for 8 years without many people noticing. A lot of them went to Brazil's best university. And what they want to be, what they are, is a social movement demanding the full decommodification of transportation. So in the long term, they want no bus fares, no prices for the subway. And every time there's a bus rise from 2005 to 2013, they have a raucous anarcho-punk style protest. You know, they believe in direct action. They believe in prefiguration. So they block turnstiles. They shut down streets. Things often end with battles with cops. And it seems like they know that that's always how it's going to go. And that's, you know, kind of what a lot of the punks, you know, punks show up, like actual punks show up, and the punks are up for that. And that happens without a lot of people noticing until 2013. Now, in 2013, Brazil is governed by Dilma Rousseff, who is a former Marxist guerrilla, Brazil's first woman president, who has won an election by quite a lot. Fernando Haddad is the mayor of Sao Paulo, also from Lula's Workers' Party, so like the big hegemonic left-leaning party that has grown out of the workers in Brazil. He's the mayor of Sao Paulo. He's won his election decisively, and he said in his campaign that he was going to raise bus fares. So the MPL do what they always do. For four protests in June, they shut down streets, they block turnstiles, and they cause havoc for Brazil's military police. And the military police is a legacy of the US-backed dictatorship. So they succeed in the first four protests at causing problems for the state, but not at really getting the people on side. Brazil's mainstream media, controlled by oligarchs, calls for a police crackdown on June 13th, 2013, essentially saying this has gone on far enough. These kids have made their point. It's time to clear these punks off the street. Now, it's quite relevant that Brazil's media class is not from the part of society that knows what it feels like to be repressed by the military police. If they were, they probably would have known what was coming when they called for a crackdown, because the crackdown comes and it shocks them and it shocks the nation. It is relevant that the crackdown also hits people like me and you. It hits like white journalists at the dominant mainstream media or like, you know, respected center-left media. And so the script flips. Mainstream media in Brazil goes from saying, we got to get rid of these kids, to actually this is a patriotic uprising in defense of the right to rise up in defense of things. It's like becomes very vague. They don't exactly know why it's good, but they start to say that it's good. And then just 4 days later, you have a lot more people showing up. And these people that are showing up, and this dynamic goes back to what happens in the 60s.
And they're
as
showing
well.
Up because they've seen police hit people in the face
yes.
on Twitter.
These people are showing up not because they're members of the MPL Facebook group, not because they know exactly what the MPL stands for, but because they've somehow gotten a piece of media, either on Twitter or on Facebook, that has shocked them, or they've watched television. And this matters a lot in the 2010s too. There's like, the narrative is often it's all social media, but like it's the interaction between old and new media. And these new people that show up are different. They have different ideas as to how to protest. They have different politics. And I watch up close, like this strange meeting of the two groups where they like, look at each other and they don't know if they can really work together, and they try to sort of build a bridge, but the new people are there because of what they saw either on their phones or on television. And this changes very quickly the dynamic of the streets. And it takes the streets in a direction that the original anarchist leftist organizers of this uprising had never anticipated.
And so the bit that I still find surprising is that the bit I understand, you've got sort of like a bunch of hardcore militants who every year they protest for free fares and they do it. And then there's a protest that gets a little bit bigger and then some people get hit by the police and like a hot girl was like massively, you know, bloodied by the cops, right? And then that goes viral. But then you say this becomes, I can see why that would create a bigger protest next time around. But you say it creates then the biggest protest movement in Brazilian history.
Well, since at least 90s, in decades at least.
And so how, like, what's the background conditions that means that sort of a few people getting hit with batons builds in and a sort of movement for free bus fares when, right, you know, the socialist mayor got elected saying he's going to raise the bus fares. The ingredients of that to become the biggest movement in Brazilian history. That's what I was kind of like dumbfounded by.
So this is, I mean, that's a really interesting question. And it's essential that to answer it, either journalists or social scientists or anybody else necessarily are kind of inserting their own interpretation.
That was the first part of my conversation with Vincent Bevins. To listen to the whole thing, and as I say, we do cover an awful lot, you'll need to become a Crash Course supporter. You can do that by going to patreon.com/crashcoursepod, and you can sign up for as little as £3 a month. There will be a part two of this conversation going out soon again. The first 30 minutes of that will be going out on the free feed. For now, you've been listening to Crash Course with me, Michael Walker. Editing is done by Lewis Bassett and Patrick Herdman, and Patrick Herdman does the sound design.